This is a CBC podcast.
On June 12, 1972, five-year-old Adrian McNaughton wandered away from his family at a lake in eastern Ontario. He disappeared without a trace. Host David Ridgen, who grew up in the area, goes back in search for answers. Someone Knows Something, the new serialized crime podcast from CBC Radio. Subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Hello, I'm Wei Chan. Welcome to the Ontario Morning Podcast for Monday, March 14th, 2016. Amazon's virtual assistant, Ramona Pringle, told us about Alexa. Brockville's a finalist for Hockeyville Prize. Ron Zajac had details. How to avoid scams. Jose Russo had advice. Special White House correspondent. We talked to Stuart Reynolds in Stratford. The common and misunderstood cold sore. Dr. Raj Bardwaj told us more. And March break survival tips. We talked to blogger Michelle Ferrari in Peterborough. How would you like a gadget that turns on your lights, tells you the weather, and reads your favorite sections of the news before you even get out of bed? That is exactly what the Amazon Echo does. It is described as a virtual assistant for your home, and after being greeted with some skepticism when it was released last year, it's now attracting more and more interest. This weekend, some of the country's best and brightest tech minds converged in Toronto for a hackathon to find ways to make the Echo even more helpful around the house. To tell us more, we've got Ramona Pringle with us. She's our tech contributor and an assistant professor at Ryerson University Faculty of Communication and Design. Good morning, Ramona.
Good morning.
Sounds a bit like Apple Siri, is it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. I think that that's the starting point for sure. The things that they've done a little bit better, she's a little bit more responsive. Their speech recognition is really good. But as you were mentioning, it was met with some skepticism. And I think that that's exactly why, is that it didn't seem all that innovative. And so people made fun of it. The tech writers and the early adopters, when this first hit the market last year, even if you go onto YouTube, you can see there's a lot of spoof videos and a lot of people were making fun of this this new innovation, because it was Amazon really trying to make a foray into the market, and they had tried making a dent in the smartphone market, but they just could not compete with Apple and Google and Samsung. So they came out with this device, which is a smart, screenless, voice-controlled. It's this cylindrical tube that you put somewhere central. So you put it in your living room or you put it in your kitchen. And, you know, I think exactly as you're saying, it felt like, well, how is it really any different than Siri? But what's really interesting is as people started adopting it, they've started admitting that they actually can't live without it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, it does a lot of tasks that Siri does. You can ask it to play music. You can ask it. It's hooked into all of your other networks. You can ask it to, if you have a smart home, a connected home, as you said, ask it to turn on your coffee for you. Or as you're cooking, if you realize that you've run out of olive oil, you can ask it to either add olive oil to your shopping list or just go ahead and order it and have it delivered to your door for you through Amazon's massive shopping network that they've got in Amazon Prime. But what's interesting is people are admitting now that the very same people who thought it was embarrassing almost have admitted that they got hooked. They say, you know, when Alexa calls an Uber for you, or when it starts telling jokes to your kids, or helping them with your math homework, or does reorder that olive oil for you, all voice activated. That's the difference with Siri, is that you can either refer to this device as the Echo, which is the name of the device, or in its personified name, which is Alexa. So you could say, hey, Alexa, call an Uber for me in 5 minutes. So it becomes this character in your home, this virtual assistant in your home. And people say you start wanting pretty much everything in your life to be Alexa-enabled as well. And
then you realize, no, she can't actually cook the meal for you.
I know. I wish she could do the laundry.
It's funny. It's this sort of cylindrical, as you said, device. Looks like an air purifier or something. Mm-hmm. How does it actually work? It's just connected online then?
Yeah, it's connected online, and so it's not, you know, the privacy concerns come up all of the time when we have these kind of devices. Certainly with the Hello Barbie, it came up. With the Samsung Smart TV that was voice activated, it came up. But when it hears those prompt words, which is either Echo or Alexa, it starts listening to what you're saying. And they did a very good job. And this is where, again, it seems like it wasn't that innovative. But because the speech recognition is as good as it is and they keep trying to make it better, she can hear you. I think one of the things that goes awry quite often when we are dealing with these smart AI or computers in our lives is that we end up talking like robots to try and get them to understand us. And so we have all this technology that, you know, here we worry that the robots are going to overthrow humanity. And if anything, they're not becoming more human. I think we're starting to turn into robots just so that these robots can understand us.
So what were some of the other cool things that people came up with at the hackathon?
Well, this hackathon over the weekend, they came up with the winning design. There was a team called Team Tribal, and they came up with something called My Fridge. And, you know, it's interesting that I brought up the olive oil example, because I really do think that because it's hooked in with Amazon, and if we know Amazon first and foremost as a shopping platform, and I think that that's really where it revolutionizes. It really makes things convenient in terms of shopping and shopping lists. So Team Tribal came up with this project called My Fridge, which is there to really take food inventory and also recipe suggestions. So what they say is you come home from the grocery store and tell Alexa as you're unpacking what you've bought, and if you bought a new meal, you got a 2-gallon milk, and tell her the expiration date. And what she'll do then is she'll know what's in your fridge. Here I am talking about Alexa as if it's a human. It will remind you when your milk is about to expire. It can either add it to your shopping list or just have a new milk sent to your house before it expires. But also, knowing what you have in your fridge, it will send you daily suggestions of what you could possibly make for dinner. So if it knows that you've got the broccoli and some cheese and some chicken, it'll suggest a recipe and actually send to your mobile phone a recipe suggestion based on what you've got in the fridge. So that was one of the Toronto team or one of the Canadian team's suggestions that they came up. There was a date hacker that gives you some pointers and suggests good date spots before you go out and reminds you to pack mints before you leave the house. Those kind of suggestions, but they really are virtual suggestions. It really is trying to turn it into this hybrid of a best friend and a very smart connected device.
In just a couple of words, Ramona, this is not available though, unfortunately, in Canada. Do we know when it would be?
You know, I reached out to Amazon for that because the big question in my mind, I have one. I brought it back from California, and it's been frustrating trying to get it to work here because you need not only to have the device, you also need to have an American Amazon account for it. And they've been a little bit cagey. Amazon wasn't going to give details about when it was coming out in Canada. However, their lead Amazon advocate, their lead Alexa advocate, the person who is pushing this device, did come up to participate in the hackathon. So makes you wonder that it must be around the corner pretty soon. If not coming soon, we certainly have a really tremendous development community. And I think that's another exciting piece here is just the opportunities for our interactive community to be developing for this new platform.
Well, thanks very much for introducing us to her.
Thank you. Nice speaking with you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ramona Pringle is an assistant professor at Ryerson University's Faculty of Communication and Design. Vote early and vote often. That's what Brockville residents have been asked to do until midnight tonight. It's totally legit, though, because they're trying to get their city elected as the winner of Kraft Hockeyville 2016. There's a lot on the line, including a hefty sum of money. Ron Zajac's been watching the campaign. He's City Hall reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, and he's with us on the phone now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, anyone who watches Hockey Night is familiar with Hockeyville, but for the uninitiated, what is this all about?
Well, Kraft Hockeyville is it's an annual competition. It's sponsored by Kraft Foods as well as the NHL and the NHL's Players Association. And communities are made to compete with each other to demonstrate their commitment to hockey for the purpose of winning money for infrastructure improvements that will benefit hockey, usually arenas, or as in our case, an artificial ice rink in our West End called Rotary Park.
And so what was Brockville's sales pitch then?
Well, we have an area of town, the west end of town, called Rotary Park, which used to be the site of our old hockey arena before the roof on it collapsed many decades ago, in the 1980s, actually, I believe it was. And since then, the pad has remained, among other things, and it's been used for outdoor hockey all this time. Recently, we've been able to upgrade it by adding artificial ice surface to it, so it's got all the piping and everything for artificial ice, and it's part of a large-scale project to redevelop that entire West End Park, Rotary Park, for the purposes of outdoor recreation. And we've had a volunteer citizens group. They've done a tremendous job of fundraising and getting that project done. And the coup de grace, if you will, the crowning achievement is to put a roof, an open-air roof, on top of this ice pad that would allow for greater use in winter, even when it's not the most temperate of weather. It would protect it and allow for outdoor hockey tournaments, that sort of thing, and the whole community's rallied around that.
Yeah, so everyone, eh? Not just hockey enthusiasts.
No, it's really a community pride project. It's about revitalizing an area of town that was neglected for some time. It's about showing our pride in our national sport, but it's also showing our ability to sort of rally around something and get it done in whatever way possible.
How did people react to being in the top 10?
Well, there was quite a party going on when it was announced, and people have gotten behind the next phase of the project. It was an achievement, really, for a community our size and for a project taken on by a volunteer group. We had a young professionals network that really spearheaded this top 10 drive. Among other things, we had an outdoor winter classic that also involved an indoor game in our other arena, our newer arena, featuring Montreal Canadiens alumni. So a lot of things were done to make this happen, and there's a lot of pride that we got it done, but also rolling up our sleeves and voting now for the next phase.
Yeah, there's these different stages. And when I was voting last night, which I did, I'll be proud to say I voted for Brockville. I voted twice because it doesn't stop you from, you know, more than one vote.
No, it's a really, it's a strange thing, but that's the way it's set up. And you can vote as many times as you want. After a couple of times of voting, you get this visual prompt to tell them that you're not a robot. You have to match their separate images to prove that you're actually a human voting. But there have been events in town. One of our local pubs even catered an event in the community hall of our other arena to have a voting station or voting stations open, and people can sort of enjoy a bit of food while they keep voting as often as they can.
Because I guess that's the important thing. You still have to make it to the next stage.
Yeah, the top two. The top two, there'll be one in the east and one in the west. I believe it's the 19th that it'll be announced. Each of these top two finalists will get $100,000 for their particular chosen hockey infrastructure upgrade. We've already had $25,000 now for having made the top 10, but that'll be upgraded by $75,000 if we make the top two. And then the winner among those top two, one in the east, one in the west, the winner of that will get to host an NHL preseason game.
Awesome. Well, Ron, thanks very much for telling us about it. So, as I said, vote early, vote often.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Bye now.
Goodbye.
Ron Zajac is a City Hall reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times. And no, you do not have to live in Brockville to vote for Brockville as this year's winner of Hockeyville 2016. Turns out you can't always trust the cold display on your phone. Scammers are using a technique called spoofing to make it look like you're getting a call from a reputable source. Last week, the Toronto Police announced they were being impersonated, and a lot of Canadians have been getting calls from scammers pretending to be the Canada Revenue Agency. March has been designated Anti-Fraud Month here in Canada. I spoke with RCMP Corporal José Rosso, the call center supervisor at the Canadian Anti-Fraud Centre. Give us a sense of just how big a problem this is.
Fraud is very big in Canada. Just in 2015, the Canadian Anti-Fraud Centre received over 50,000 complaints, and it shows a loss of $81 million. And that amount of money is only 5% of the people that reported to us in 2015.
Right. There's probably a lot more that didn't think to call.
That's right. A lot of people do not call because they feel a certain shame or they don't think it's important to report it.
What sort of scams are we talking about?
We're talking different type of scam. The most prevalent one right now is the CRA scam. The CRA scam is classified for us as an extortion. So you receive a call at home, and they tell you that you owe money to the Canada Revenue Agency. And they tell you if you don't pay, you will be arrested or there will be a warrant of arrest against you.
And so, but how do they convince me that they are CRA?
They do that by first spoofing a number. So you'll see a number showing a 1-800 number, which could possibly be from the CRA. And they will do that also by scaring you. So this tactics works right now.
How do they get money from me?
They will ask you to send money via different payment options. The most popular one are Western Union and MoneyGram, which are legitimate companies, but they're very easily transferring money. So you send your money, like you go bring your money there, and it's gone, and it's not going to be traceable afterwards.
So this is called a spoofing scam. So sometimes you get spoof phone calls. Sometimes you get spoof emails as well.
Yes, that's right. So they copy a real number, making you believe that you are receiving a legit call. It could also be a spoof number showing a local number because people have tendency to answer a number that they will think they know instead of a number that doesn't make sense to them.
They're getting very sneaky because a lot of these emails look really like they're from the bank or the company that you do business with.
Exactly. So they will spoof the logos, the name of the banks, making you believe that you are really receiving an email from them.
And why do they do this? Is it just to scam us out of money, or is it for something else?
It could be for identity theft, but it always comes down to stealing your money.
How do you recognize if they are so savvy at creating these emails and these phone calls, how do you recognize that they're not a legitimate?
It's so difficult to see that the best thing to do is prevention. So what I mean by prevention, you receive an email, you receive a call, do not send money right away. Do not give your information right away. Just take a deep breath. Look for the real number of your agency or company you're dealing with and give them a call and confirm with them that they're looking for that information or that money.
Mm. So do you ask the person on the phone, for example, to give you a number to call? I guess not.
No,
you have to do it independently.
Exactly. You do not ask the fraudster to give you the information. You go yourself. Let them know. I will call back. Thank you. You hang up. You go on the internet. You go onto your receipt, bill receipt you have at home. Take the number there and call.
What are some other popular ones that you're seeing?
We see the romance scam is really popular, so it's people that are looking for friendship or romance via the social network services, and they will meet people, and then the person will develop a trust with the victim, and then they will start asking for money.
Okay, and that's usually when the alarm bells should go off, I gather.
Exactly, because some relationships are really good, but some of them, as when they start asking for money, you should have an alarm going on.
Are there certain groups of people or age groups that are more susceptible?
All age groups are susceptible for a scam. So a different scam work better with different age group. Example, the grandparent scam will work with older people who have grandchildren or children. CRA scam will work with people who work. The identity theft will work with people that are onto social network and give a lot of their information.
Yeah, and so often you don't even realize this has happened because maybe your friend was hacked, you know?
Exactly.
And you end up clicking on something by accident. Okay, so knowledge is an important thing. What else? Okay, so what else can people do to protect themselves?
It's to it's to look for the signs. So high pressure demand could be somebody calling and really pushy, is very pushy to having your information or to having you send money. A request for cash is very telling. Immediate payment, not tell anybody that you're going to send the money, is also very telling. Yes.
Is there a recourse after you've been scammed? Is there any hope of getting that back, or are you out of luck?
When the money is gone, it's gone usually. It's very, very, very difficult for the police to get your money back because they're outside the country most of the time. Also, they're a group that they use phones and then disappear. So the investigations are very difficult. So the best thing is not to pay at the first place.
Right. And I guess the reason we need to call to complain is so that then you can send out alerts to other people to
warn. Exactly. So the best, if you do get scammed, advise your local police, call the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center, let them know.
José, thank you very much for speaking with us. Hopefully we've helped somebody out there.
Thank you for having me.
José Rousseau is an RCMP corporal and the call center supervisor at the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. We reached her this morning in North Bay. Well, media from around the world covered all the glitz and glamour of the Prime Minister's state visit to Washington last week, but how many of them could boast about having an actual gold embossed invitation from the White House? Well, Stuart Reynolds can. He is a social media star from Stratford. He creates Vines under the name Brittle Star. Vines are 6-second videos. He has over 770,000 followers. Just maybe one of them is in the Oval Office. Stuart was asked to be a special correspondent for the White House last week. He's back home now and joins us to share his experiences. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing after the time change?
I'm doing fine. I'm surviving.
Okay.
I'm surviving.
Good. Now, Stuart, how would you describe the Vines, those little mini videos that you usually make?
Well, there's 6.5-second long videos. And when you make videos that are that short, that half second really counts. So you really have to get it in there.
Yeah, okay. So 6.5 seconds.
Exactly.
And how would you describe the ones that you do and the appeal of them?
So to me what they are is essentially, well, to describe them, they're small videos. They loop, so they're 6.5 seconds long. And the style of content that I create is more comedic and sort of family friendly, and I like to sort of think of it as like the equivalent of you know, newspaper comics, like a Farside cartoon, that type of thing, except in a video form and on your phone.
Yeah, totally. That's a great description. So how did you react when you were chosen to cover the Prime Minister's state visit for the White House?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where the call had went out for people who might be interested in social media, and I responded to that and kind of didn't think anything of it. And then when the email came through saying, you know, you've been invited to come, it was one of those things where I didn't say anything. I didn't want to tell anybody until I was actually there because it didn't seem quite real. I thought, why would the White House call me to get to go, you know, to this event? Like, why do they want me?
You were afraid to jinx it?
Yeah, totally. And I think it's quite funny because since we've returned, my wife's family keeps calling saying, yes, but why did they want him? Why him?
And do you have an answer?
I usually just sort of say, well, of course they want me. America, you know, put out a call for help and I was there.
I saw the photo that you actually tweeted. So you really, really have an actual invitation from the president.
Yes, it's quite cool. I mean, how often, you know, how many people are able to say that they have something to say, you know, the president, Mrs. Obama, invite you to? And that's pretty surreal. I'll be making a trip to the framing shop today.
As you were going across the border, too, boy, you must have been excited. What was going through your mind?
What was going through my mind as I crossed the border was I'm ready for U.S. Customs, because people who go across the border realize U.S. Customs, sometimes they can ask a lot of questions, and that's their job, and that's fine. And I was waiting for the question, what's the purpose of your visit? And I thought, I'm so ready to say, I've been invited by the White House, and say it like an action movie. But I didn't get asked.
Oh.
It was so sad.
Oh, what a letdown.
I know. And I thought surely on the way back home, the Canada Customs would ask the question. No, they didn't ask either.
Oh, so. My goodness. Because they already knew you, Stuart. They knew. They saw you
exactly.
In the news.
Exactly.
What were some of the highlights for you of being at the White House?
I think it was just the whole surreal aspect of it, of being you know, going through security, getting through the security checkpoints, and then being led up to the front doors of the White House. And we were within about sort of 20, 25 feet of the White House front doors. And just kind of looking around and going, well, this is really weird. Like, how did I end up here?
Yeah, because you've seen pictures and you've seen, you know, in the movies too, right? Those iconic images of the White House.
Yes. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, as a tourist, I've been to Washington before, and you stand, you look either from, you know, the front to the back of the White House, and you can sort of see it and go, oh, yeah, that's the one that's in the movies. And then when you're actually there, you sort of think, ooh, there's like there's thoughts in your head going, well, it's a little bit smaller than I thought, but it's also really big. So.
What were some of the vines that you created?
I did a couple. I did one I did, which has been quite successful, has been me listening and standing in the front of the White House, and the announcer says, and now the National Anthem of Canada. And one of Nickelback's songs starts to play, and I look horrified. No offense to Nickelback. And the other is I announced to kids, if you have any haters, let me know who they are, because I'm at the White House, and I'll tell the president. And what's really fun about that one is that people have actually been listing people's names in the comments that they want me to tell the president about.
How many special social media correspondents were there with you?
There was a total of 9 of us, actually, in the group, and they were, it was interesting because I was the only social media video creator there. Everybody else had websites and had worked for companies and larger brands. So it was kind of, I felt special to be there because it was just me and sort of based on the content that I create. So it was, I felt honored.
Yeah,
sure.
And really, you know, an elite group.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was there.
Yeah. So. But who knew, right? Like, look at how far you've got. You're like a tastemaker, Stuart.
That's right. Yes. Tell my family.
You know. But how difficult is it, though? Because it's like you're improvising in a way, right?
Yeah. I mean, you kind of have to. I mean, certainly the kind of vines and videos that I create will be more sort of thought out in sort of productions where you're kind of, you know, you're planning in advance and that type of thing.
Yeah.
But one of the exciting things about being able to make a vine is that you can largely do most of it on your phone. And then if you can kind of take advantage of special surroundings, that's the great thing. I mean, how ridiculous is it for me to be standing in front of the White House and have Nickelback playing? That's ridiculous, and that's fun.
Yeah, you didn't even have to write it. It wrote itself.
I know, exactly.
So is this still just a hobby for you, Stuart, or is this now your day job?
It is now. In the past year, it's become 100% of what I do, actually. It's the past 3 years for me have been really, really bizarre. They've gone from making vines that are kind of silly and just kind of for fun, and then working with a whole bunch of great companies and brands, and now it's 100% of what we do, which is amazing.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? The evolution of social media. Hey, Stuart, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
All the best.
Take care.
Stuart Reynolds from Stratford, a.k.a. Brittle Star on social media. He was asked to be a special correspondent for the White House last week during the Prime Minister's state visit. Cold sores are a very common infection. Two recent papers from the World Health Organization reported that more than half of the people in the world carry some form of the herpes virus, the source of cold sores. They may be more embarrassing than dangerous, but they can create a lot of anxiety. Last week, a teenager in the U.S. made headlines when he developed cold sores all over his face, and he believed that he got them from a gym mat. I had a chance to speak with family doctor Raj Bardwaj. I started with the obvious question, what is a cold sore?
So a cold sore is a skin blemish, but it's caused by a very specific virus. It's called herpes simplex virus, and there's only two of them. There's herpes simplex 1 and herpes simplex 2. And we used to think that if you got it around your lip, like a regular cold sore, that was HSV-1. And if you got it below your waist, that was HSV-2, and that would cause genital herpes. But now we know that both of those viruses can go anywhere. And we actually just call it something different depending on where it is. So if it's on your lip, it's cold sore. If it's on the genitals, it's genital herpes. If it's on your finger, we call it herpes Whitlow. Mm. If it's on your eye, then it's herpes conjunctivitis or herpes disease keratitis. It's initially spread by skin-to-skin contact, but you can actually transfer it from one place to another on your own body. So there was a doctor that I worked with in the summertime who had a mosquito bite on her ankle, and she also had a little bit of a cold sore on her lip, and she was absentmindedly touching her cold sore, and then she was scratching her mosquito bite. And a few days later, she came in with a little scratch on her ankle with three little cold sores in that scratch, because she had transferred her own virus to a different location, and now she will forever get little cold sore outbreaks on her ankle as well as on her lip.
Oh my goodness, that sounds terrible. Now, so can you actually get it then from touching a gym mat?
Yeah, so this is an interesting story, because theoretically you could. The herpes virus does survive outside the body on surfaces for a few hours. But there's a little bit of old thinking going on here. So the young man in the wrestling competition says he probably got it from the mat because he didn't wrestle anybody who had a cold sore. But that's because, you know, we used to think that people only shed the virus. They only transmitted the virus when they had an actual sore. And we know now that people can actually shed that virus even when they don't have a cold sore. So he could have gotten it, especially since it's on his face, he could have actually gotten it from another wrestler who was shedding the virus but didn't have a sore. Now, the first time you get exposed to herpes simplex virus, you actually do tend to get a little bit sick. So you get a little feverish, a little achy, maybe some swollen lymph nodes, and then eventually you'll get a sore or a cluster of sores. And then your body fights those, but it doesn't completely get rid of the herpes simplex virus. That darn little virus goes and hunkers down and hides in a nerve. And then from time to time, it will reactivate right out of that same nerve, which is why people get the same cold sore or wherever they're getting a sore on their ankle or their finger or wherever. They'll get it over and over in the same spot.
Oh, how does it get reactivated?
So that's a good question. Something happens and the virus takes advantage of it. So some people say that stress can cause reactivation. Some people say that lack of sleep or even just being dehydrated can do it. We know for sure that local trauma can do it. So even sunburn. So I see people, they go out skiing or something, they get a little bit of a sunburn on their lips because they didn't put sunscreen or lip gloss with SPF, and then they'll come in with a bunch of cold sores. I even have some patients who every time before they go down on their winter holiday down to Cuba or Hawaii or whatever, they will actually come in and say, can I have a refill of my cold sore medicine in case I get an outbreak while I'm out in the sunshine?
I've heard of people too, that if their lips get too dry, cracked in the wintertime, that they're prone to getting them as well.
Absolutely.
Now, is it a bit of a myth though, that because some people say, oh, you got a cold sore instead of a cold?
No, the cold virus is completely different from the cold sore virus. So we, in the old days, we actually used to call these fever blisters. And you only get the fever the very first time. But then anytime you get an infection that causes a fever, that might be a good excuse for the virus to reactivate. So it has nothing to do with colds. It doesn't really have anything to do with fever. You could be completely happy, healthy otherwise, and then all of a sudden get an outbreak of herpes simplex virus.
You said that you actually give people prescriptions. Is that how it's treated, or can you just use the over-the-counter stuff?
So we have a bunch of options, and it depends on sort of how bad it is, how aggressive you want to get with it. We know that we can't cure herpes infection at this point, but we can control it quite well. So the first rule of thumb is that the sooner you hit as soon as you start the treatment, as soon as you hit the infection, the better it is. And our options are three. Sort of the first class is non-prescription creams. So those are the over-the-counter ones that are advertised on TV, and they very proudly state that they shorten the length of time that the cold sore is present. That's true, but only by about 12 to 18 hours. The second group is prescription creams. Those are an actual antiviral cream, not antibiotic, but an actual antiviral that also might have a little bit of cortisone in it. Those will also shorten the length of time that the cold sore is present, usually by a day or two. So a little bit better than the non-prescriptions. And then the third option is prescription pills. Those are the only medications that really work for the first infection. They're the only ones that work for genital herpes. And they're the ones that doctors would use in hospitals for people who are really sick, or even if you've got them on your eye or something, we might give you pills plus some antiviral eye drops. But those ones, if you have just a regular cold sore, if you start on the pills as soon as you feel the tingling and the sore is coming. A lot of times that will actually prevent the sore from forming altogether. So we can sometimes prevent that once you already have the infection.
Once you already have it. But what about not getting them at all?
This is a tough one. Health Canada says that 70% of Canadians have HSV in their system. So it's really tough to avoid people. And we know that you're going to be sometimes shedding that virus even when you don't have a sore. So it's not as simple as, you know, not sharing lip gloss or not sharing drinks with somebody who has a visible sore. So it's the usual stuff that doctors like to harp on. And we harp on it because, you know, it works for a lot of things, but wash your hands, don't have unprotected sex, don't share food or lip gloss or things like that with people who have a cold sore. And then once you have them, because they are awfully hard to ignore and awfully hard to avoid, once you have them, then try not to do those things that might trigger them. So the cracked dry lips, the lack of sleep, the being overstressed. And then last thing, don't be ashamed of these. Talk to your doctor about it. Go in and talk to them because we do have these effective medications as well.
Dr. Bardwaj, thank you very much for this.
My pleasure.
Dr. Raj Bardwaj is a family physician in Calgary. March break begins today for most Ontario students, but not everyone is riding roller coasters at Disney World or scuba diving in the Caribbean. Many people will be spending the week at home, and keeping the youngsters occupied, as any parent will tell you, is no small task. Michelle Ferrari is a mother of three and a parenting blogger. She joins us on the phone now from Peterborough to offer some tips on how to survive March break. Good morning.
Good morning, Wei. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing well, thank you. I was a little bit sleepy after the time change, but okay.
Well, that's the first thing I have to say. I'm like, smarty pants. You can even hear it in my voice. It's tired that they decided to put March break on the back end of the time change, because my kids are all still in bed.
Yeah, but that's a good thing in a way,
I'm thinking. Oh, absolutely. It's brilliant, right?
So you've got three, so they're between the ages of 6 and 12. What have you done in the past?
Well, it changes, right, as they get older. And I think one of the big things is exactly what you've just said. I think if you have lots of money or there's a budget for it, you can sort of go every day and go somewhere and have day trips or go away and go to the Caribbean and go scuba diving. But as they change and as they age, and now I'm self-employed. So that also means if I take the time off work, I'm not getting paid. So you just have to be a little more strategic in what you're doing. So we do all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the two big points I would like to make is, number one, there's a reason there's a March break. And I think it's really important for parents to remember that these kids and our kids need the break. So, you know what, they need that break from that schedule, from that going to bed, getting up, packing a lunch, whatever it is, they need a sort of break from that monotony. So I think don't over-schedule them is something really good. I know even the other day, just movies, staying in your pajamas a little bit longer, staying at home can sometimes be really great. Now, by about the third or fourth day, you better have something in place.
Yeah, because pajama day can only go so long. No, and the other thing is, I think we get a little freaked out. Not necessarily them. I think my daughter probably be fine being in pajamas for a week, right? And doing nothing. Yep. But we feel like, oh, we shouldn't be, you know, wasting this time. We should be doing something with them, you know, a family activity. So what do you do about that?
Well, it's really true. And you know what? There's this really great article. I just happened to read it while I was waiting to chat with you about our kids have too many toys. And you're exactly right. It comes back and forth between the parent and the child, right? And we get our knickers in a knot. There's different types of kids, right? I know my friends have some kids and they have to go, 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 go. They're just a high energy kid. They're in, you know, three different sports and they thrive on it. And then you have kids, mine are on the other end of the spectrum where they're like, let's just sit and not go out. They want to stay in. So I think the other thing really important is to have some sort of plan. Mm. When the kid knows there's a plan, everybody seems to function better and they don't get all worried and including the parent too. So if we know, okay, on Thursday morning, we're going to the library. Mm. On Tuesday, we're going to go to the dollar store. Everybody gets $7.50. You get to pick out what you want for the day. That's what you get. You know, if if you have a plan, they are a lot more receptive to it too, because they have something to look forward to.
Right. Okay. So you've got those sort of unusual outings planned. Mm-hmm. What sort of things can you do at home with them?
Well, I think one of the best things, I actually just was writing about this too, because I think one of the best things that's underestimated now is we also get ourselves worked up about screen time, right? Because all parents are worried because they can easily fall into that movie and video game and become sucked into Minecraft and all those other games that they can play. So I think it's really important to pull them away from that and have that as a schedule as well. And do board games, do cards, do those things where you can do it with them. Like kids love playing games with their parents. They love beating their parents. They think it's the best thing, right? Like, you go play a game of Go Fish or I have Battleship with my one son. They love it. They're like, I don't give a shit. I'm like, yeah, I know. Or cooking. Cooking is brilliant too, right? Because it chews up a lot of time, and you can also, you're doing a lot of learning in that. And you're teaching them to clean up too, hopefully, if you can handle the mess at the beginning and know that they will clean it up.
Yeah, and really absolutely. Effective. It's such an mm-hmm. important skill for them to mm-hmm. have. And they need to know all the family recipes too.
Yes. Yeah, totally. Like, they love it. It's just having a patience. A lot of it, you're so right, Way. A lot of it has to do with us as the parents. Like, oh, I don't want to deal with that mess. I don't want to deal with that chaos.
You know, I have a friend who, and I thought this is a great idea, who organizes with a bunch of other moms the week, sort of like these camps like you're talking about, almost like one day it's a cooking camp at my house, for example, mm-hmm. and then the other days of the week, the other moms host so that at least somebody gets a day off. You get one day off.
Yes, and we're doing that actually this morning.
Because, are you doing that?
Yeah, it's so true. Because, and the other thing that that does, not only does that help, it's like that community cycle kind of thing, but it also helps when you have ages and stages. So I've got a 12-year-old who's really not interested in what the 6-year-old wants to do. So if we meet up with other parents that have kids the same age, they can break off. So my 12-year-old can break off with another 12 or 11-year-old, and they can go and do their thing. And the 6-year-old can go and do their thing. And the 9-year-old can go and do, you know, they can break off, and it gives a lot more choice for the kids, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, mm-hmm. So one tip then to share with us on how to keep your sanity.
I think just, you know what? Don't have too high expectations. Don't overschedule, but have a plan. And I know that sounds kind of like contradictory, but it's not. Have a schedule that's opened a bit, but you know what? Have a plan too. And the kids have to be a part of it. They love it.
There
you know
you
what?
Go.
Tuesday we're going here. Wednesday we're doing this. Thursday we're doing this. Friday, if we get all this done, we get a movie and we get some chips and we get some pop.
There you go. Give them the choices. Hey, Michelle, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot, Wei.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Good luck. Michelle Ferrer is a mom blogger based in Peterborough. So are your kids staying home during March break? What are you doing? Share your survival tips on Terry Morning at cbc.ca.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.